From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today on All Tech, data mining for conservative Christians. A new organization is targeting millions of unregistered believers and trying to persuade them to vote in the next election. As NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty explains, the idea could be a game changer, though it comes with a few hitches.
When Bill Dallas heard that 15 to 20 million Christians are not registered to vote, he couldn't believe it.
Initially, it surprised me. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, I'm not registered. I said, well, why wasn't I registered? Well, because I didn't think my vote made a difference.
Dallas has since become a voter and now runs United in Purpose, a startup nonprofit company that uses data mining to identify unregistered Christians. The company persuaded wealthy Silicon Valley conservatives to help fund a database of every adult in the country. It buys lists to build a profile of each citizen and then assigns points for certain characteristics. So Dallas says you get points if you're on a pro-life list or a traditional marriage list, if you regularly attend church or homeschool your kids, if you like NASCAR or fishing.
If it totaled over 600 points, then we realize you are very serious about your faith. And then we run that person against a voter registration database. And if they were not registered, that became one of our key people that we were going to target to go after.
Dallas hopes to register 5 million people in the next year, which he believes could help decide the 2012 race. To that end, the company is recruiting volunteers from places like the Family Research Council to make the calls and knock on doors. They're called champions.
My name is Scott Spages. I'm a 25-year political activist.
Scott Spages from Davie, Florida, signed up as a champion because he feels that electing moral leaders is a biblical mandate.
God says that when the righteous rule, the people rejoice, and when the wicked rule, the people groan. So as a Christian, we are specifically called upon by the Bible and by God to raise up our leaders.
Spages wants to bring that message to his Christian neighbors, so he logs on to the United in Purpose database, enters his address, and the database finds unregistered Christians nearby.
And so now I have maybe 15 names have popped up, mostly in my vicinity.
Spages heads off, Google Maps in hand. The first person lives in a gated community. The guard won't let him through, so he makes a phone call.
Yeah, my name is Scott. I'm here as a volunteer for the Family Research Council. We identify him as a Christian who's not registered to vote. Oh, okay. Okay, so Orlando and everybody in the house is registered.
It happens at the next house and the one after, so when Spages reaches Brenda Jacobson to ask if she wants to register, he's not surprised.
Well, I'm registered, okay. So I'm not sure why my name showed up.
And we found that a lot tonight. We found a lot of people. No, we're all registered, everybody's included, so I'm gonna have to double-check that with them.
Turns out all the names on Florida's list are registered, a mistake United in Purpose discovered after NPR's reporting. Now, in Ohio, the database worked perfectly, and 67-year-old Kay Clymer was eager to use it. Clymer is a Tea Partier and evangelical Christian in Zanesville.
I do strongly, strongly believe that the Lord's totally in control. I pray for a Red Sea experience like he did with the Egyptians, and wash those people out that don't belong in office. And that's what keeps me going.
A woman answers. Clymer pitches.
I'm Kay Clymer, and I'm with Champion the Vote and United in Purpose. And I'm out trying to get people to vote that maybe might not be registered. Are you registered to vote?
I'm not, but my husband is.
Would you like to be registered to vote?
No, I wouldn't waste my time on any of them.
At the next house, it's a bit more prickly.
I'm sorry, they're all crooks. And so you'll never be able to blame me.
I'm just trying to get Christians to go out and vote.
Yep. Well, I'm Christian, but as far as it's going to go.
Okay. Clymer leaves, discouraged.
I'd like to wish one person would at least take it.
But no one takes a registration form that afternoon. Afterwards, I called Bill Dallas, the head of United in Purpose, to tell him the results. He was embarrassed that they botched the list in Florida and philosophical about Ohio.
When you look at all these factors, you realize what a Herculean effort this is to try to bring in a large group of new voters into the voting population.
Dallas's experiment shows the promise and peril of having a bottomless well of data to draw upon. Accessing it is one thing. Using it effectively is another thing entirely. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we hear the story of one fashionista who's been searching for a way to mix her love of fashion with her practice of the law. We'll hear where her journey took her in a minute. It comes from our weekly peek into the Washington Post magazine. But first, we want to talk about those anti-American riots in Afghanistan, where more than 30 people have been killed, according to the Associated Press. It all started about a week ago when word got out that copies of the Quran, the Muslim holy book, were burned at Bagram Air Base by American personnel. That set off a wave of riots across Afghanistan. Two American service members were shot and killed over the weekend in a secure area, and the Taliban are claiming responsibility for a deadly car bomb at Jalalabad Airport. The U.S. military acknowledges that the Qurans were improperly disposed of, but officials say it was a mistake, and there is an investigation underway. And a number of administration officials, including President Obama and the head of NATO forces in Afghanistan, General John Allen, have apologized for the incident. Here is a clip of the Pentagon's Peter Lavoie apologizing to a group of Muslim Americans at a mosque in the Washington, D.C. area.
We at the Department of Defense regret and apologize for this incident. We are fully investigating it, we are learning from it, and we are committed to ensuring that such an incident will never happen again.
We wanted to talk more about why this incident has caused such an intense reaction, so we've called on two regular contributors. Both are Muslim, and each has a different view of the ongoing controversy. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of themuslimguide.com, and the author of the book Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era, and you know him from our weekly barbershop segments. Asra Nomani teaches journalism at Georgetown University. She also conducts cultural sensitivity trainings for the U.S. military and American law enforcement, and you may recognize her from our regular parenting conversations. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
So, Arsalan, I'm going to start with you. Can you explain why the burning of the Quran has been treated with such an intense reaction?
Well, I think it's all about context. Even though there's not one uniform way that Muslim scholars say that a Quran should be disposed of, burning the Quran is one of them. But again, it's about the context and who's doing it. And so I think what most people were concerned about was the fact that not only was the Quran burned, but it was essentially incinerated with other garbage, as opposed to giving it to Afghan allies, which NATO forces have, and them disposing of it. So I think that's the context that we're talking about here.
Asra, what's your assessment? What's your take on why you think this has caused such an intense reaction?
Well, I think it's interesting Arsalan used the word context, because to me, what we are really in is a culture war between the culture that, you know, has responded to this burning of the Qurans with violence and our culture, where we hope that, you know, an apology will be an apology and just be taken as that. And I think, you know, a lot of Afghan culture, a lot of Muslim culture is what you call a high context cultures, where there isn't just a book that's being burnt, but that it's a symbolic word of God to many people. And then it also reflects this deeper grievance, right, against the West. And so context isn't actually just today and the war in Afghanistan, but then you end up bringing up decades and centuries of grievances. And so in our culture, I think we oftentimes have the tendency to be wound collectors, and this becomes the latest wound.
Asra, since you've been teaching cultural sensitivity to people in the military and also people in law enforcement for a while now, what are some of the things that you teach them and about the Quran? Do you have specific teachings about the way that the book itself is to be handled? For example, Do you teach that, say, non-believers should avoid touching it at all? Or what are some of the things that you teach?
I don't teach that non-believers should not touch the Quran. What I try to definitely teach is sort of an intelligent approach to understanding Islam that doesn't look at it as monolithic, that understands that many people have different perspectives on the Quran, that, you know, we actually do have atheists within the Muslim community also. We have people who look at the Quran as a research book. We have people who, you know, don't have the reverence for the Quran as the word of God. And just like Christian theology has many different approaches, but But I also teach that, you know, there is this narrative inside of our community that has accepted it as the word of God, and that, you know, we struggle inside our community with what the reverence that we hold for it, because, you know, Islam was brought to the world with this idea that it was against idolatry. But to me, we've really started engaging in a sort of phenomena that I call Quranolatry, where we virtually worship the Quran as a thing beyond just a book.
Arsalan, what do you have to say about
that? Well, again, I think that, you know, none of this can be viewed in a vacuum. You know, we have to look, when you look at the war in Afghanistan, you know, most recently, as Astra and I were talking about before we came on air, you know, the most recent controversy was the video of American soldiers urinating on Afghani corpses. You know, and even in terms of the Quran burning, this wasn't the first time that it happened. In 2010, at Bagram Air Base, a similar situation occurred. Bagram Air Base also holds a very strong visceral reaction with people, because after 9/11, it was one of the CIA's black sites where a lot of purported torture happened. And with the Quran burning, I think it's also important to look here domestically. We all remember Florida pastor Terry Jones, who, in a publicity stunt, went around the nation saying that he was going to burn the Quran. And so I think that it's more indicative of how people in the East tend to view us in the United States.
Okay, but let me just stop you on this whole question of the military. One of the things you cited, which is members of the military who were videotaped, apparently urinating on some corpses. These weren't just like random people. These were combatants. And some of these combatants were also visiting terror upon Afghani civilians. And so I think what might be puzzling for some Americans is, why is it that the sort of the treatment of combatants and is conflated with and seemed as an insult to Islam overall?
Well, again,
or is it being treated as a propaganda tool?
It is. Well, so, I mean, it is. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when incidents like this occurs, this only serves as propaganda tools for people like the Taliban to say that, you know, we're committing these bombings now in reaction to these Quran burnings. And that's why I think, you know, obviously, you know, Asr and I, you know, we condemn violence in any form, and we think that, you know, no violent reaction should happen at all to these sorts of things. But again, it can't be seen as a vacuum. You know, these are the proverbial straws that broke the camel's back. And so, you know, when soldiers are urinating on dead corpses, this is in violation of the Geneva Conventions, which is something that even the Pentagon has admitted. You know, so it's more about, you know, after 10 years, this has become America's longest war. You would figure after a decade in Afghanistan, we would be a little more culturally aware of a country that we've been occupying. And it's clear that we've not reached that point yet.
We're here from two of our regular contributors, Arsalan Iftikhar and Asra Nomani. And we're talking about the ongoing controversy over the U.S. military burning copies of the Muslim holy book at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. A number of U.S. officials have apologized for this, including the president. But it has set off a wave of violent attacks, including the murder of two American service members at a secure area in Afghanistan. So Arsalan, do you think that the president and these other officials were right to apologize for this?
Absolutely.
Because as you know, that there are a number of people, conservative critics,
right,
who are saying that he went too far.
Well, absolutely. And it's really interesting because they, you know, the Republican primary candidates are acting as though this is the first time that a president has ever apologized to a Muslim world leader. Let's not forget, in 2008, President George W. Bush personally apologized to Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki when it was found out that American soldiers in Iraq were using Quran during target practices. You know, 2004, President Bush apologized for the Abu Ghraib scandal. I mean, again, you know, this is just it's a political football that the Republicans are using right now. They don't have, you know, the same standard for their own president.
Asra, do you think that the president and other high government officials were right to apologize?
Well, we're absolutely not in a traditional conventional war. You know, we're in a culture war also. And in doing that, we have to practice something that I call cultural jujitsu. And so saving face is really important in that society. And in that way, you know, inside of our Muslim community, it's incumbent upon us to really change the way we relate to the Quran and not take it as this book that has to be honored to the point where human life is valued less than the book. I mean, that to me is completely unacceptable. And the U.S. shouldn't placate the lowest common denominator of our community.
What would you like to have come from this? And Arsalan, I'll go to you first, and then Asra, I'll give you the last word on this. Arsalan, what would you like to come from this incident?
Well, you know, I think with any global controversy, you know, you hope that it becomes a teachable moment where something obviously like this doesn't happen again. But from our own side within the Muslim community, I do agree with Asra to an extent. I think that it is important. You know, I've said on my Facebook and Twitter feeds ever since it's happened, I said people who kill people over burning the Quran have obviously never read the Quran before, because the Quran is more than, you know, a bunch of pages that are bound together. It's a universal message to Muslims worldwide.
Asra, what would you like to see come from this? And I take it you would like the teachings and the learning to be on, you know, both sides of the equation, as Arsalan was just saying as well.
Yeah, I want us to all, you know, try to rise to the highest expression of humanity. And that means that we try to be respectful to each other. We are in a war, and we can't forget that, I think. And so a lot of these symbols, a lot of these politics is played out for the purpose of war. And I just hope that we can all, you know, try to go to a deeper spiritual understanding of how we want to relate to each other instead of, you know, just responding to offenses with violence.
And before I let you go, Astra, you essentially, I say you are working with members of law enforcement and the military. What has been your experience so far with the people that you're teaching?
You know, I went into it traditionally thinking like, oh, folks are going to just be really hard about things. But man, I noticed that there's this cultural gymnastics virtually going on where people are like bending over backwards, trying to figure out how to do things properly. Listening to General Allen's apology was a little bit uncomfortable for even myself, because I was like, wow, when he, you know, was a little boy and wanted to be a soldier, I can't even imagine that he pictured that this is how he would express himself one day. But this is the new war that we're in. And I noticed that people are really trying hard to figure things out, and they get a really hard time. But sometimes I'm like, wow, you know, you're really twisting yourself up trying to understand a culture and to relate to a culture that is so foreign from your own. But I see the effort really being made.
Asra Nomani teaches journalism at Georgetown University. She's also a cultural sensitivity trainer for the military and law enforcement, and she's traveling in Salt Lake City right now, and she joined us from there. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of themuslimguide.com, author of the book Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era, and a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable, and he was here with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. And today we are speaking with someone who has taken what some might consider an unlikely path to a role as a faith leader. Now, if you are a fan or a follower of reality shows, then you probably know the name Omarosa Manigault. She earned her stripes as many people's favorite villain on The Apprentice and The Celebrity Apprentice for exchanges like this one with journalist Piers Morgan.
I have absolutely no respect for Piers. My whole mission was to break him down. And I knew his weak spots, and I exploited them.
The mother of your children hates you, Piers, and your children hate you, Piers. They're embarrassed by you.
But now Omarosa has a mission beyond making fellow celebrities suffer. After a period of study, she has been ordained as a Baptist minister. She is serving at the Weller Street Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles as an assistant pastor, and she is continuing her studies toward a doctorate. And so the Reverend Omarosa Manigault joins us now to tell us more. Welcome back to the program, and congratulations to you on this next stage of your life.
Thank you so kindly, Michelle, for having me on.
How did you experience your call?
Well, I think for me, it was kind of a unique journey. I believe that I got my call very early on in my Christian walk. And if I understood earlier in my life what a true call was, I think I would have responded and not waited until I was 38 years old. But the definitive call, I would say, really came when I was in the Gambia in 2008. And I was doing some work there, and I ended up at the SOS village in the section where the children were there essentially with HIV/AIDS, and they were sent there essentially to die. And I found myself in this room with these babies by myself, and I truly could hear the voice of God very clearly, and I understood what my mission in life needed to be.
What do you think that call means you are meant to do now?
Well, the great thing about having such wise and informed people in my life is that I don't have to clearly define what I need to do. This is truly a time of discernment for me. So essentially, I continue my seminary studies. I continue to serve as assistant pastor at Weller Street Missionary Baptist Church, and I continue the missionary work that I've been doing for the last 10 years.
You know, obviously, many people know you best from your time on The Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice. And
as well, they should. Yeah. 28 million viewers tuned in every week to that show.
Exactly. And you were known for, you know, throwing some sharp elbows. And if I may say, I think people know by now that you're kind of playing a character in a way as a villain, which is one of the things that some people liked about you. Feel that, you know, women should do more of that, maybe throw a few elbows. But I am wondering how you,
reconcile. To say that there are women every day who have to walk into the boardroom and they have to face some really tough opponents. They have to face men who are unyielding and unapologetic about being tough in business. It's very interesting that I've been characterized as a villain for being a tough woman in the boardroom on The Apprentice specifically, which is a competitive reality show. And so I find it very interesting, but I don't apologize at all. I will forever be a very smart, tough businesswoman. And I wish more women would stand up for themselves and not be pushed around and not be walked over and looked over in the business world. And so I understand that people struggle with that. And the duality of my personality is that I will forever have the essentials of who I am. That's Omarosa, tough, unyielding, and outspoken. But my spirituality doesn't have to be put into a box separate from those parts of my life. There are a lot of people who do some very interesting things, who work in very interesting professions, who are also Christians.
Well, that was my question. What I was going to say is that one of the reasons I think you have a following is that there are a lot of people who think, you know, more women could stand to throw some elbows. More women could stand
Absolutely.
To be ambitious and aggressive on their own behalf.
Absolutely.
But your new profession, if you will, even though there are many prominent ministers who are very strong personalities, the tradition of Christian leadership is servant leadership. Right. And in some ways, it involves the suppression of ego. As we know, the famous, you know, Martin Luther King phrase is, if you want to call me a drum major, that famous speech about being a drum major, saying I was a drum major for justice. So that was my question, is how do you think you want to use those two aspects of your career and personality together?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned servant leadership. I spent so many of my years, my professional years, teaching leadership and understanding leadership. And the one thing that you have to have is a point of view as a leader. My point of view is that I really do believe that everyone should have their own and define their own spirituality. And for me, I follow the teachings and the beliefs of Jesus Christ. I do not apologize for being a Christian. I love praising and really telling everybody that will listen about the Lord. But what becomes very interesting to me is that people feel that you cannot live a regular life when you're a Christian. And so I guess if people were to look at me and to look at my life, they will know that, you know, your life as a Christian has to go on day to day, and you can spread the word of Christ in every place that you go. I fortunately have a huge platform to tell everyone that will listen about the word of God. And so if people criticize me for using the media to tell people about Christ, that's on them. For me, I have to use the gifts that God have given me to the best of my ability to spread the word of God.
Well, I hope you'll come back and tell us more about this interesting new phase of your life and how you implement all the aspects of Omarosa that people have come to know and be interested in.
Absolutely. And in fact, folks can see me preach live. We have a Weller Street Live. We stream our services every Sunday, Weller Street Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles.
Will you be preaching?
I'm preaching Sunday morning.
Well, what's your sermon going to be about? Can you give us a hint? Have you thought about it?
You know, I selected a text last week, and last night I got this inkling to preach about remembering Lot's wife, where she was instructed not to look back, and she did, and that was her destruction, and that was her demise. And so I think my lesson this week will be not to look back, and really taken from the text of Lot's wife.
That was the Reverend Omarosa Manigault. She was recently ordained as a minister in the Baptist tradition. She's currently serving at Weller Street Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles as an assistant pastor. And she was kind enough to join us from New York, where we caught up with her at NPR's New York Bureau. Reverend Omarosa Manigault, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. God bless.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Leaders of the Mormon Church are clarifying the rules around a central church ritual, baptizing the dead. Mormons around the world are getting word in church today that they risk disciplinary action if they violate the policy. Proxy baptism, as it's called, has long been controversial because Mormons have been known to baptize people outside the faith, including prominent Jews and victims of the Holocaust. The controversy, rather, has even touched the presidential campaign of Republican Mitt Romney, himself a Mormon. Today, Mormon bishops have been told to read a letter in church that says these baptisms can only be carried out for Mormon ancestors. NPR's Howard Berkus joins us now to talk more about this. Howard, Jewish leaders have been complaining about these baptisms, particularly of Holocaust victims and prominent Jews, for more than 20 years. Why are Mormon leaders warning followers about this now?
Well, I think there are at least three reasons. First, these 20 years of complaints by Jewish leaders have been met by 20 years of promises and attempted fixes by Mormon leaders, and they haven't actually worked. Second, the fact that they haven't worked has been underscored in the last few weeks with the names of the parents of the late Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal, a Holocaust survivor himself, found on Mormon baptism records, then the names of the father and grandfather of Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, then Holocaust victim Anne Frank, then Daniel Pearl, the Jewish Wall Street Journal reporter who was killed by terrorists in 2002. And third, as you mentioned, Mitt Romney, the first Mormon who has a very real chance to become president, he was drawn into the fray when Elie Wiesel called on him to condemn these unwanted baptisms. Romney did not respond.
Now, Mormon leaders are saying that the policy is to restrict these baptisms to direct ancestors. This has been the official policy. Howard, has it just not been enforced?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that the policy was clear or clearly stated or stated certainly with the threat of consequences until now. One of the top officials of the church told me just 3 years ago that Mormons concentrate, first of all, on their ancestors and then the people in the world at large. Well, that doesn't sound like a practice with limits. I mean, it's only been in the last few weeks that the church has even publicly announced punishment of Mormons who've been found to be responsible. Two members lost access to the Mormon genealogical system that's used for these baptisms. That's the penalty Mormons are going to hear about today, along with other possible but unspecified corrective action.
And is there a political element in any of this? Have you seen any evidence out there that these revelations about these kinds of baptisms could be an effort to discredit Romney or the Mormon faith?
Well, the church has suggested that that there is deliberate mischief out there, but there's been no proof of that. And, you know, this long predates Mitt Romney's campaigns for president. Overzealous Mormons, the church has called them that, with what to them are very good intentions, have been doing this sort of thing for a very long time.
Finally, Howard, how unusual is it for the top leaders of the Mormon church to deliver this kind of global edict like this in a letter read in every church service in every congregation around the world?
You know, Mormon leaders only reach out to members in this way when there's something that's so important to the faith that they want to be sure that every member is going to hear about it. There have been times in the past when key issues come up that the church feels need to be addressed globally in the organization, messages that have to be unmistakable, absolutely clear. They're delivered from the pulpit. And those messages are put in writing and signed by church leaders. And it's very clear. The messages do not violate this policy. Your president and prophet says so. This is a very strong signal that they want this persistent controversy to end.
NPR's Howard Berkus. Thanks so much, Howard.
You're welcome, Rachel.